From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Beautiful, just beautiful. New Horizons, the little spacecraft that could, made it to Pluto. 3 billion miles from home, perfectly on target, vacuuming up visual images, spectral imaging, and more. New Horizons is already shooting on out to the great beyond. Its stream of images and data have just begun to arrive home. This hour on Point, the mission to Pluto and what that frozen dwarf planet is telling us already. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you been watching? Does that lonely little rock surprise you with its moon and canyons, mountain ranges made of ice? Is this how we get space exploration right? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. It's been a while since there was so much excitement from space. On Tuesday at the Missions Operations Center at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory, one of my guests today, Missions Operations Manager Alice Bowman, confirmed receipt of a signal from the probe.
Copy that. We are in lock with telemetry with the spacecraft.
Was it exciting? Yes, it was exciting. Here's astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, famously demoted Pluto from planet to only a dwarf planet a few years ago. But still, he's been hyped this week as the images came streaking back. Here he is talking in an online interview with Stephen Colbert.
It's not every day where you get to be the first eyes to set upon a completely undiscovered land.
This is beautiful and exciting.
It is especially beautiful and especially exciting because no one has seen this before yesterday.
Everybody piling in, here's astrophysicist Stephen Hawking.
The revelations of New Horizons may help us to understand better how our solar system was formed. We explore because we are human and we want to know. I hope that Pluto will help us on that journey.
Pluto mania this week, and we are only too happy to join it. Those images, the information coming back, and it will come back for a long time now. With us from the Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland, is Alice Bowman, officially known there by her acronym MOM, M-O-M as in Missions Operations Manager. Her job was to get the New Horizons spacecraft across the solar system and on target to Pluto and beyond. She's been one of the stars of this mission in all the press coverage, and we could not be happier to have her with us. Alice, welcome, Earthling, to On Point, and congratulations, boss.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
What a great week. Also with us from Washington, where she's following all the images at NASA headquarters, there is Emily Lakdawalla. She's senior editor, planetary evangelist at the Planetary Society, which was co-founded by Carl Sagan in 1980. She's also contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Emily, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you today.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I should say, by the way, we have links to Emily's blog posts on Pluto and NASA's webpage with the images pouring in from Pluto at our website, onpointradio.org. Alice, how on earth did you do this? 3 billion miles is a number that boggles the mind. Nine and a half years on its way out there. Was there a question at some point along the way ever whether you would hit the target, come close enough to give us these images?
Well, I guess I'd be not quite telling the truth if there wasn't some concern that we could actually get the spacecraft safely out that far away from Earth. But we were just so busy making sure everything was going to work, that the commands were good, that these 9.5 years just sort of passed quickly before us. And all I can say is that we kept our eyes on the ball and we just took it step by step, and then it's amazing. We arrived, and I think all of us were so very surprised. It's like that time passed so quickly, and then all of a sudden we're here and we're getting these beautiful images down of Pluto and Charon. And I know we overuse that word amazing, but it is. It's just simply amazing to see that planet revealed before our eyes.
3 billion miles. We need Carl Sagan to say billion to drive home just how far that is. But we know it's a long way. I want to dig further into the mission itself, the mechanics of getting this New Horizon out that far. Emily Lakdawalla, what about the first images and data that are coming back now? You've been following the planets and space for years and years. Your first big takeaways from what we're seeing in these brand new, first ever real images of Pluto?
Well, these images are absolutely incredible to look at. And I think the most surprising thing is there's a lot of debate about which thing in the solar system that we have already seen was Pluto going to look like. And the answer is not really any of them. Pluto is a unique world. It has such diverse terrains. It's got white spots and dark spots. It's got mountains that we don't understand and all kinds of other interesting features and not very many craters. And that tells us it's also a youthful landscape. And it's just absolutely fascinating to geologists.
Mountains the size of the Rockies, and is it? Can we know those are made of ice, like top to bottom, Emily? Is that clear?
Absolutely. You can know from the density of Pluto, which is one of the things you can determine from Earth, it's got to be made largely of water, ice, and rock. And so you know that water ice is the main constituent. You also know from laboratory experiments how incredibly hard water ice is at the temperatures out here in the distant reaches of the solar system. Water ice on Pluto behaves almost exactly mechanically like rock does on Earth. So it is possible to build huge mountains out of water ice, but I still can't tell you how they're built. I'm looking at them right now and I don't understand them.
Rockies-sized mountains of ice, and yet that smooth, relatively smooth complexion, not just beaten up by and near eternity of things bashing into it, but kind of smooth, which people say means there must be some heat that's shaping sort of shaping Pluto over time. What could the source of that heat be if we've got mountains made of ice?
I think it's safe to say that geophysicists don't know right now. It's when you originally form icy worlds in the solar system and they condense, the gravitational potential energy turns into kinetic energy as they come together. There's a lot of heat generated by friction as things come together, things heat up, and you melt that ice. So all these worlds started out with a lot of liquid water in the beginning. But that was desperately long ago. That was, you know, more than 4 billion years ago. And so it is really difficult to explain how a world could still be active at that distance from the sun all the way down to today. And I personally know some geophysicists who are scratching their heads right now trying to come up with a reasonable explanation for this.
We're going to dig more deeply on that. Alice Bowman, you're the boss in getting everything out there. We all wanted to cheer along in that little clip where you're saying, copy that, we're locked in telemetry with the spacecraft. Explain that to us, Alice. Was there a time when New Horizons had gone dark or was not transmitting? Was there a moment where you were waiting with bated breath for these images to come in? What was that cheer for?
Well, you know, that spacecraft is, you know, it's so very, very far from Earth, three billion miles. And we're sending out ones and zeros bits to that spacecraft and telling it what to do. And that spacecraft is sending us little bits back. And, you know, it's always one of those moments when you know you have a scheduled track or pass or contact with that spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, space is big. They say there's not, you know, people say that, you know, it's mostly empty. But gosh, you just never know. And so every single time we make that handshake with the spacecraft and we establish that communication link, it is a little bit nail-biting because you just don't know. This is, you know, this is why they call it exploration. So when we saw that carrier was coming in, which means that the spacecraft's there and its transmitter is on, we knew that, you know, half of that battle was over in establishing that telemetry or data lock on the spacecraft.
And now at this point, when we see these images, how long does it take them, the ones and zeros that make up everything we see back here, how long does it take for them to make that 3 billion mile journey or more, ultimately, I guess, back to Earth?
Well, they're sent from the spacecraft about 4.5 hours before they arrive on Earth. And since we are moving away from Earth, as we get farther away, they're going to take longer and longer to get to Earth. And each of those images or spectra, it takes a different amount of time to be received on the ground. So like an image might take 3 or 4 hours at a certain data rate. And so each is a little bit different. We have larger data sets that might take on the order of 5 or 6 hours to get down.
Alice, take us back to the beginning of the launch and propulsion of this toward Pluto. The thing that everybody talks about is how you put a quite small probe, sort of baby grand size, about 1,000 pounds, on top of a very, very large rocket, which gave you the speed and push to get out there. Describe the setup.
Sure. We finally got that mission to Pluto on the books for NASA. They gave us approval. And the last thing we wanted to do was to play around and wait. So we wanted to get this mission or the spacecraft built and hopefully record time. We used the RTG, or radio thermoelectric generator, on board to power the spacecraft. And so we built the spacecraft in 4 years. We used an Atlas V to launch it. And that rocket, if you have a small spacecraft and a rocket with a large amount of thrust, the smaller that spacecraft is, the faster you can propel that spacecraft into space. And so we tried to make the spacecraft small as we could and still accomplish the objectives. And we tried to load as much propellant on board the spacecraft as we could and still meet that criteria of getting it out there as fast as possible. One thing we wanted to do, one of the reasons we wanted to get it out to Pluto as quickly as we could, is because we wanted to study the atmosphere. And the theory is that as Pluto moves farther away from Earth in its, or I'm sorry, farther away from the Sun in its orbit, that atmosphere will start to collapse or freeze onto the surface. So the sooner we could get to Pluto, the better chance we had of studying that atmosphere.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking Pluto this hour, the superstar, almost planet of the week, the year, the mission, the images, streaming in, the view from way out there, the YouTube kids show, Science with Tom celebrated New Horizons flyby of Pluto and its moon, Charon or Charon or Charon, however you want to say it, by putting new words to the old hit tune, My Sharona, right here. Alice Bowman is with us, Missions Operations Manager for the New Horizons mission that has sent back all these terrific images this week and much more to come. Emily Lakdawalla is with us as well from the Planetary Society. She's following all the data that's coming in, and you are very welcome to join us this hour. Everybody's been thinking about it, having fun with it, talking about it. Here's Stephen Colbert again with Pluto planet denier, Neil deGrasse Tyson, trying to get him to admit that Pluto's really a planet. Colbert tricked him with his trademark tortured logic into agreeing that if a car is a car, a planet is a planet.
Why do you believe that it is not a planet? It sure damn looks like a planet. It's out there in space where the planets are. It's got a moon, which is the size of Texas. Okay?
If Neptune,
next you're going to tell me that Texas isn't a planet.
If Neptune were a Chevy Impala parked at the curb,
yeah.
Ask yourself, what car would Pluto be?
A Matchbox car.
That's exactly what it would be.
Car. Matchbox car.
Oh.
Check. Mate. Checkmate.
I don't think Stephen Colbert is going to solve that debate. We'll look at it today, but here is New Horizons' actual lead scientist, Alan Stern, at a press conference Tuesday night in Laurel, Maryland.
I'd like to characterize that DSN pass you all just watched as one small step for New Horizons and one giant leap for mankind.
Emily Lakdawalla, do these images, do the data so far come to bear on this funny debate about whether or not Pluto is a planet?
Not particularly, and I can tell you that it's a question that most of the science team isn't that concerned about. They're concerned about what Pluto is and how it got to be what it is, and not to mention Charon, which is just as exciting as far as I'm concerned, and very surprising. It has almost no craters on it. That, too, is a very young surface. It doesn't look like any of the outer planet moons that we visited before very, very particularly, and so I'm really intrigued to find out what they're going to have to say about that.
We'll look at that. Alice Bowman, you're the boss who got the equipment out there and got the images back. Do you care if it's a planet or not? Does it mean something to you?
Not at all. I think Pluto is special in its own right, and it's worthy for us to go out and explore it, whether or not it's a planet.
Let's dive in on what's there and dive in with our listeners. Harlan, Kentucky, Tim is calling. Tim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Tim.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
And I want to first say to Ms. Bowman, thank you so very much for this fantastic mission. I'm a child of Voyager myself. I remember the grand tour of Jupiter when I was in high school. It's just so amazing to see these things. the thing I wanted to talk about where they talked about the possibility of some form of geothermal type heat emissions. Recently, they got back data up from the Rosetta mission to a comet where they believe they detected some form of possible biological activities going on, some form of liquid salts, if I remember correctly, some form of mineral that allowed a liquefied environment, and what they would figure would not be possible at such incredible degrees of temperature, so low. And possibly we might be seeing something like that if Pluto was pretty much an aggregate of cometary material. It's logical to assume that it might have the same type of material that we might find on some of these comets, and that we might be seeing the thermal energy that's being detected from these outcroppings might be actually some form of biological waste heat, and the mountain projections that we're seeing could be the production of millions of years of biological heating going on. And say when Pluto comes into a warm phase, you get more biological activity under the ice cap if there's some form of liquid water down there. And then when it starts to go into a freezing thing, it might be a frenzy type of like a lemming effect where the biological energy is released at a much greater degree, and that might produce these mountainous structures.
Tim, let us pick up the whole heat issue. Alice Bowman, another hat tip there, and again, I want to come back to that mission. But Emily, let's dig into the heat. I mean, I've seen different potential explanations here, radioactive decay on the planet, or this one I didn't quite understand, but energy released by the gradual freezing of an underground ocean. Maybe you can explain how the freezing of an ocean releases energy that would heat a planet, or Tim even asked about biology. I don't know. The remains of an ancient civilization. What are the possibilities here, Emily?
Well, I think he makes a good point that life is at least as likely on Pluto as it is on a comet, but I don't think that very many scientists really think that life is all that likely on Rosetta's comet. There are several ways with physics that you can generate heat in the interior of a body. Freezing water does actually release heat. It's sort of surprising, but it does. And so as oceans freeze, you do get heat being coming off of bodies in the solar system. You also have heat generated by any kind of radiogenic elements that are inside the rocky core of the world when it first formed. And there are a lot of icy worlds in the solar system that, if they formed fast enough, could have incorporated quite a lot of radiogenic elements before they had a chance to decay. And that would have generated a lot of heat in the interior that would actually have had a very difficult time escaping. And it takes quite a lot of geologic time, mm-hmm. tens to hundreds of millions of years or more, depending on the size of the body, for that to escape. I think for a body the size of Pluto, it's smaller than all the planets. It's bigger than some of the moons. It's smaller than some moons. It's right in the same size range as a lot of Saturn's moons.
Sort of two-thirds the size of Earth is what I'm reading here.
No, it's not nearly that big. It's okay. Two-thirds of the size of Earth's moon.
Oh, excuse me. That's a very different thing indeed.
Yes, it's a very different thing. So it's smaller than all of the big moons of Jupiter. It's smaller than Neptune's moon Triton. Mm-hmm. But it's larger than the middle-sized icy moons of Saturn, like Tethys, Dione, and Rhea.
Okay.
And so a lot of the geophysical theory that's been developed to understand how those moons have the surfaces that they have applies very well to Pluto. But if you look at Tethys or Dione, those are two moons with a lot of craters all over their surfaces. So that tells you that their surfaces are very old. And if you look at Pluto and Charon, there are way fewer craters than anybody expected to see. So that tells you there's a couple of possibilities. Either the surfaces are much younger than the surfaces of the moons of Saturn, or there are many fewer impacts happening at this area of the solar system much further out, and they're also happening with a lot of lower energy and lower speed. It may be that we don't understand the impact rate, and so what looks like a young surface to us might actually be quite old. Or there could be something else generating heat inside that we don't understand yet. And I can tell you that this is a puzzle that scientists love to be puzzled. And so this is really exciting to have a chance to get their teeth into something that they didn't expect and didn't predict, and now they're going to have to try to understand it.
I mean, the thing I've heard the most chatter about was the last of those, that there was, because of the heat, there could be a kind of surface rejuvenation going on here, some kind of, you know, night cream that smooth things out over eons. I don't know what that would be exactly, but if it's a more dynamic planet, could there be a kind of self-healing of craters?
Well, sure. Basically, you have some kind of process that erases the craters. And on Earth, the way that we erase craters on Earth is with water flowing across the surface, mm-hmm. or with volcanoes spilling lava on the surface. On Pluto and Charon, you wouldn't have rock lava. The thing that is ordinarily behaves like hard rock and then could, if heated enough, flow like a liquid would be ice water. So water as a ice builds mountains, and if something can make enough heat, you can melt that and you have liquid water flowing across the surface. And so there are areas on Charon in particular that are very smooth looking. They look as smooth as the lunar maria, the flat-lying dark areas on the moon. And so those really, to my eye, they look a lot like places where maybe cryolava, water lava, flowed out across on the surface at some time in the past.
Amazing. We'll continue looking at that side. Mackenzie in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Mackenzie, you're on the air.
Hi. I thought it was really interesting that, I'm 22 years old, and so, you watch these things being launched whenever you're younger, and it's just like a little blip on the news.
Yes.
And then, it doesn't really mean anything to you, but suddenly, we're seeing these images come back of planets we've never seen before, and it, suddenly does mean a whole lot to you, especially after so many years and seeing all the advances we've made. I did have a question. I know that they were talking about kind of the inexplicability of the mountain ranges and things like that, but also the freezing of the atmosphere. Could that possibly have anything to do with creating those mountain ranges, the fact that that atmosphere freezes and kind of collapses onto the planet every time it gets so far out into the solar system?
Yes, I wanted to pursue that as well. And Mackenzie, I'm so glad you called with that. Alice, did you feel the hot breath of a deadline here, that if you didn't get there in time, the atmosphere might freeze onto the surface and what, obscure your New Horizons view of the planet, the body?
Yeah, we sure did. We had a launch window, and the very first part of that launch window in 2006 would allow us to fly by Jupiter and use Jupiter as a gravity assist. And what that means is that we stole some speed from Jupiter. We actually sped up the spacecraft mm-hmm. to about 22 kilometers per second, which is extremely fast. And that shortened our journey to Pluto by about 3 years. If we had not made the first part of that launch window, then it would have taken us much longer to get to Pluto. And the possibility was that when we arrived, we would not have that atmosphere or maybe as much of that atmosphere to study.
How close did you have to come to Jupiter to get that slingshot effect?
I think we flew by at about 12 RJ, and that is the measurements, the radius of Jupiter 12 times.
Okay. And Jupiter is, of course, very big. While we have Mackenzie calling here, I just have to ask, I saw a piece in The Atlantic about this project, The Atlantic, the magazine, and the headline was "The Women Who Rule Pluto," saying the New Horizons team may include more women staffers than any other NASA project in history. I mean, you're the boss, but could you feel that this team that's had so much success here did have a different gender complexion than previous teams?
Well, I never looked at it that way. I just looked at it as working with my colleagues, trying to get a mission to Pluto safely and then take great science. And I think perhaps the number of women on this project is a testament to all the different steps that are taken to try to get more interest by women into these science-type fields. So I think it's great, but I can say that it didn't feel different at all.
Great answer. Answered like an NFL quarterback there, Alice. I love it. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had read that the chances of reaching Pluto is like hitting a hole in one across the United States. I wanted to ask Emily if she ever thought that this mission was not going to succeed.
I'll put it to both of my guests. I mean, Emily, we sort of got that to Alice, but what about you? This sort of mind-blowing, to us ordinary Earthlings, it can seem very unlikely. As Jim says, like hitting a hole in one when you're, hitting the ball across the USA. Did it? Is it amazing just from the face of it to you that we could go that far and do this? Or is this just a matter of math and telemetry?
Well, I do want to thank Jim for giving me the opportunity, excuse me, to express my admiration for Alice and everyone at the Applied Physics Laboratory who got this spacecraft where it was. It is very hard to do, but there are very intelligent, competent people doing this work. You do have to plan very far ahead. You have to have budgets and support the funds necessary to get all of those incredibly smart people, incredibly reliable machines to make their way to these distant destinations across the solar system. So thank you, Alice, for the hard work that you put into making this a success.
Let me own a call on this front, and I'll bring it to you, Alice. Chris in Nashville, you're on.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I was calling because I think this is great. You know, I love space travel or the idea of space travel. Obviously, I've never done it before. But it's actually why I worked on submarines when I was in the Navy, is because I was the closest I could be to something similar to being in space.
Yeah.
And kind of tying into what the last caller said, I don't hear very many people appreciating the math that goes into shooting something into the sky and it getting there to a certain spot 10 years later. But I had two questions. One is, you know, we had one probe that went to Mars that crashed because some people used metric and some people used imperial system and they didn't fix that. And so I was kind of wondering how you guys got, you know, coordinated everything. And then the other thing is that since we just flew by Pluto, it's going to go off into the Kuiper belt and just die. Was there any consideration of maybe having it go into orbit around Pluto so that way you guys can get long-term data? I know it would make it so much harder to do everything, but was that ever a consideration? Also, for the record, Pluto is a planet.
okay. Got to get it in there. Alice, that's a lot. Let us start with, if we may, just the hole-in-one long shot here. Did you have to calculate all that in advance? Were there thrusters on New Horizons that let you make course corrections along the way?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to say that it was a huge team effort, and everybody played a big part in this, not just me. I just had the honor of leading the operations team. And so, kudos to the guys that actually did all those hard calculations.
Right with you on that.
We have a navigation team, and it's very interesting because when you say navigation, you think, well, maybe GPS and things like that. But these are deep space navigation guys. We use the Kinetics group, which is based out in California. And they developed this plan where we would take optical navigation images starting a couple years out, and this is when Pluto was a very, very small point of light, and as we approach, obviously, it got larger and larger. So that data combined with Doppler data, which is sort of like the echo that you hear, you know, out there, so the Doppler data, and then we use another technique called ranging on the spacecraft. So we will... Let's see, we use the deep space antennas. There's three complexes around the world, Canberra, Australia, Madrid, Spain, and Goldstone, California. And when we do these ranging measurements, we find places where the spacecraft is in view of two of these complexes. And we will have the spacecraft be outputting a tone, a ranging tone towards Earth, and intercepted by these antenna. And it can be intercepted by antenna at both of the complexes. And then the ground antennas would turn and look at known quasars and listen for their signature. And then you can do a triangulation. And that's generally how they do navigation, how we hit that spot. I think we were 72 seconds early and about 70 miles closer to the surface.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashby.
This is On Point. It's been the week of Pluto, images pouring back across the solar system from 3 billion miles away. Astonishing images of the, what, dwarf planet? Can we settle on that for now? Coming back with all kinds of data and insight around them, things we have never seen before. Alice Bowman is with us. She's the Missions Operations Manager for New Horizons, the 1,000-pound probe that has just gone past Pluto and will send back images and data for a long time now. Emily Lakdawalla is with us from Washington, Senior Editor, Planetarian Evangelist at the Planetary Society. Carl Sagan founded it, and they're still going strong. She's been doing a lot of blog posts on what we're seeing from Pluto. Lots of curiosity about Pluto for a long time. It's been in all of our, many of our imaginations. Here's a clip from the 1960s Spider-Man cartoon. Plutonian aliens have come to New York City. They're freezing everything in sight. They're kidnapping Dr. Smarter. And here they reveal themselves as just a peaceful group trying to get repairs for their spaceship and get back home to Pluto.
We were right. They are Plutonians. Just relax and open your mind to their leader.
My fellow Plutonians and I were on our
Plutonians from Spider-Man. And here at a news conference on Tuesday, 2015, Alan Stern, principal investigator for New Horizons mission, celebrated the success of a mission he says completes the first era of space exploration dating back to that same time of the Spider-Man cartoon.
New Horizons has succeeded at completing the capstone event to the historic first era of planetary reconnaissance, a half-century-long endeavor that will forever be a legacy of our time.
I want to talk about where all this leaves us. But, Alice, if we could first get back to getting out there, you gave us some terrific insight into all the elements that come into play in this deep space navigation. What about your capacity to maneuver the probe en route to Pluto? How does that work?
Well, we do have thrusters on board the spacecraft. We have a set of thrusters that are fine, pretty much fine adjust thrusters that we use for pointing the spacecraft when we want to take images or spectra with the different instruments. And then we have larger thrusters that we use to accomplish trajectory correction maneuvers.
How many times can you use those on your way out? Is your energy supply replenished? Is it solar? What is it?
Well, we use a propellant. It's hydrazine on board the spacecraft, and we have a finite amount of that. And so we had to be very careful using that. We had to plan our trajectory correction maneuvers on the early side, because if you make a course correction early, it actually takes less propellant, and then that means more propellant to do science. So we did a trajectory correction maneuver in March, and then we did one in June, and it turns out that is all we needed to get the spacecraft where it needed to be.
And there it is, headed on out. A question here I'll put to you, Emily, about this heart-shaped geological feature that people have talked about a lot on Pluto and what it might be. Emily?
Well, you can tell actually from Earth-based telescope views with spectrometers that the heart itself is composed of bright ices with carbon monoxide and other volatile gases that have condensed onto the surface.
Is it a polar cap then? Or?
Well, it's not a polar cap. There is actually a pole, and it has frost at the polar cap, but it's not in the right place. The heart's in the wrong place, I guess.
Okay.
But it looks like it might actually have been a big impact basin that may have filled with snow. And that snow has maybe gotten blown by winds over time. Pluto has a very, very thin atmosphere, but it is possible that there's enough of it at times for it to blow things around the surface. And then we've also seen from Earth that it changes over time. So that's a great example of a feature on Pluto where we have some understanding of it from many, many, many years of Earth observations, and we'll have many more years in the future of Earth observations. And the New Horizons flyby, even though it's really fleeting, gives us a chance to kind of ground truth, to pin down those observations and help create a context for a century of Pluto exploration with ground-based telescopes.
Alice Bowman, what about our caller's question about why the decision to fly by rather than fly out and orbit Pluto?
Well, the New Horizons is just a continuation of the way first reconnaissance missions are undertaken by NASA of new solar bodies. And so the first thing you do is you fly by a planet or an object and you gain valuable information, and then you can send an orbiter or a lander later on once you understand it. The hard thing here was if you want to do an orbital mission is that you need much more propellant on board. And we talked earlier about how we wanted to make that spacecraft small in relation to the thrust on that rocket so that we could get it out there as fast as possible. To carry propellant, it's going to make that spacecraft heavier and larger. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason why, really, that it doesn't have enough propellant on board to slow down and get captured by Pluto's gravity.
Take a question here from Tucker in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Tucker, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Tucker. Are you there, my friend?
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering, how much longer is that radioisotope generator going to provide power, and will it exit the gravitational field of the sun with power remaining?
Alice?
I'm sure. We, of course, the nuclear decay will continue, and it comes down to, do you have enough power that's generated by that decay to have any kind of useful experiments on board, taking place on board the spacecraft, and also to power the transmitter that would allow us to get information back from the spacecraft. So we've done some calculations, and we think that in the mid-2030s, that's the point where we will reach that point where the power is so low that we can't establish those communications or experiments with the spacecraft.
So Tucker's ahead of me here. The radioisotope is giving you an onboard power source, and you're saying by 2030 you won't be able to send data home anymore.
Yes.
What might we learn in the meantime? It's headed out into the, how do you pronounce it, Kuiper Belt? K-U-I-P-E-R?
Yeah, I call it the Kuiper Belt.
Kuiper, okay.
Yeah, Kuiper Belt. Well, there's a lot of, we have plasma instruments on board the spacecraft. They're obviously a higher fidelity than the ones on Voyager, but they'll provide the same type of information as the Voyager spacecrafts or the Voyager spacecraft is providing. So we hope to take plasma measurements. If funded, by NASA, we have plans to visit a Kuiper Belt object. If we do that, we have one that we've scoped out that we'll encounter in early 2019. And in 2019, we'll still be able to use our imagers and UV spectrometer and pretty much the whole suite of instruments. It just might be that we have to do a lot more turning on and off so that those instruments can share the power.
Emily, can you describe for us what is beyond, on out beyond Pluto in this Kuiper Belt, a couple of billion miles it extends beyond Pluto, I'm reading here, containing billions of icy worlds. I don't know what that means. What's out there?
Well, the Kuiper Belt itself is actually a little smaller than that. It's a region of space. It's like a flattish disk of icy worlds. Some of them are big and round, almost as big as Pluto. Some of them are quite a lot smaller. And they go from about 30 times Earth's distance from the sun to about 50 times Earth's distance from the sun in a disk, kind of like the asteroid belt, only there's more bigger things in there. Mm-hmm. And then there's this big gap that so far I've only discovered one or two worlds out in this big gap. One of them is named Sedna. And then beyond that is this enormous spherical shell of things called the Oort cloud, and that's where the long-period comets come from. And that goes out to about one light year, or even almost 2 light years away from the sun. And so New Horizons has escaped the sun's gravity. Actually, it had, as of the time that it left Earth, it's on its way out of the solar system. It will continue traveling forever. It just won't be able to talk to us after the mid-2030s, like Alice said.
Won't be able to talk, but headed on out. Alice, do you expect significant data to come in over these next 15 years as it goes through the Kuiper Belt?
Well, scientifically significant, yes, I do. But if you're speaking of a large volume of data, that might be a little bit harder. But yes, definitely it will contribute a lot of new science in this region of the Kuiper Belt.
Bob in Charlottesville, Virginia. Bob, you're on the air, my friend.
Thank you. Quick question. I don't understand the acceleration by Jupiter completely because, as I see it accelerating on the way in, doesn't it also retard on the way out?
With the gravity of Jupiter, how does that work, Alice? You can get the sling off of Jupiter, but why doesn't Jupiter's gravity also pull it back?
Well, our mission design team has planned that all out, and what you have to do, there's a lot of math involved for the other caller that was asking, and you have to do those calculations. You need to encounter Jupiter's gravitational field at a particular point and in a particular part of its rotation. And that's how you get that slingshot effect and not fall into the planet.
There's another question here related to Neptune. Dan asks, could Pluto be a former moon of Neptune? Any similarities to Neptune's moon Triton? Emily?
You know, it's a funny, I'm smiling as I'm listening to that question because we actually think the opposite thing almost happened, that Triton was actually born in the Kuiper Belt and was captured by Neptune as a moon. And one of the reasons that we think that is that Triton orbits Neptune backwards compared to the rotational sense of Neptune's rotation, which is different from all other large moons in the solar system. And also because Neptune lacks any other major round moons, unlike the other three giant planets. So we've always thought of Triton as this analog for Pluto, that when Voyager 2 passed by Triton in 1989, that we got a preview of what Pluto would look like. And that turned out to be sort of true, but upon close examination, Pluto doesn't look at all like Triton up close. And so they really are two different worlds with two different histories. And that makes me wonder what all of the other big Kuiper Belt objects look like Eris and Haumea and Orcus and Quawar and Ixion and Varuna. And they all have wonderful names.
Alice, if there's so much ice, i.e. a form of water on Pluto, this may be a dorky question, but could it one day be like the last gas station, a fueling station on the way out of the solar system?
And Emily, maybe you can help me here. I think actually we're seeing more signature of water on Charon than we are on Pluto.
On
the moon. And we're tending to see more of the methane signatures or nitrogen on Pluto.
Emily, if there's Rocky Mountain-sized icy mountains, doesn't that mean water?
It does, yes. We can see, Alice is right, you can see other frosts of other volatile things on the surface more clearly on Pluto than you can on Charon, which you can see water ice signatures on its surface. But the volatile components, which sometimes freeze out of the atmosphere and land on the surface, they're just like a thin veneer, a frosting on the surface of a world that's made largely of water ice. But to answer the question, I think that if you want to refuel from water in space, which is a really good idea to do, it's much more convenient to get it in space than it is to launch it from Earth, you would probably visit a smaller body that didn't have as much gravity as Pluto does.
And that's out there. That would be available. Huh?
There's a lot of them. There are so many worlds in the Kuiper Belt. You know, it's not just Pluto and Charon and its moons. There are a great many more. There are at least 200 that are probably round, like Pluto and the moons of the giant planets. And there's many, many thousands, uncountable numbers, that are smaller and lumpier and have their own unique histories and stories to tell.
We have Kepler, no less, calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Kepler. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Congratulations and thank you to the both of you for taking one giant leap in space exploration. And my question now is that you have the 3 billion mile shot under your belt. What's the next target? Is it could it be a solar system or something else where you want to send another one of these out to?
Alice, how about it? What's the next target to infinity and beyond? What's out there for us?
Right. Well, for the New Horizons spacecraft, we are hoping that we get funded to visit one of these Kuiper Belt objects that is close enough for us to visit and learn more about this part of our solar system. And if you're talking about other NASA missions, I would really like to go back to Pluto. I would like to spend more time there and just see. Take more measurements of this fantastic world. It's just so intriguing.
But are we at the end of an era, at the end of an era of exploration, Emily, as we, you know, now learn about the last, only dwarf planet, I guess? Does that mean we've wrapped up the solar system? The next thing is beyond? Or do we turn back and dig in deeper within?
It does drive me a little bit crazy when people say that Pluto is the last thing to explore in our solar system, because there are so many places that we haven't explored yet. Mm. All those other worlds that I've mentioned in the Kuiper Belt, the moons of Uranus have hardly been explored. We've never orbited Uranus or Neptune. We need to explore and orbit the moons of Jupiter to understand the oceans of Europa and Ganymede. There's countless worlds in the asteroid belt. We've never seen the surface of most of Venus with cameras. There's so much left to do. And there are actually a great many active missions that NASA has, and other space agencies, the European Space Agency, JAXA. India recently got a mission in orbit at Mars. Mm-hmm. But there is this really frightening looming gap in our exploration of the outer planets. The Cassini mission will come to an end in 2017. The Juno mission will arrive at Jupiter next year and then end in 2017 or 2018. And then after that, there's going to be almost a decade with no active outer planet missions. So people really need to express their support to their representatives for space exploration.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you like seeing Pluto, you may have to raise your voice to see more like that in the years ahead. This is a good week to think about that and maybe to do it. It's been awfully exciting to see what's come out of Pluto. Alice Bowman, we stand in awe of your accomplishment here, Missions Operation Manager at New Horizons. MOM, M-O-M for short. Alice, congratulations. It's just a terrific accomplishment. Thank you so much for everything you've done here.
Thank you.
Just great to have you with us today. And Emily Lakdawalla at the Planetary Society. Thanks for all your space insights today, Emily. Wonderful to have you with us.
Love to be here.
Listeners, off we go again. Thanks, as always, for your great questions and insights as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Go Pluto. This is On Point.